You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
Orrin Lyons is a faith keeper of the Turtle Clan of the Onondaga Nation. He has been active for decades on issues of environment, corporate power, and the preservation of the culture of indigenous people. He spoke late last month at Ithaca College.
Well, we gather here tonight to see what we can do for Mother Earth. I think if I have a statement to make tonight, I would say I am appalled, outraged at the lack of leadership in this political world that we function. I am outraged at the lack of political will to look after life. I cannot believe, in the face of all the knowledge that we have, that leadership continues to be irresponsible and negligent and criminal with our lives and the future. Leadership has to be visionary. Leadership has to look ahead, has to be able to see into the future, has to be able to chart a course, a good course for life. A long time ago, I read a book in 1984, and they talked about doublespeak in there. I was fascinated with that book. But that's what we're faced with today. Very slick talkers can look you right in the eye and lie to you and tell you that black is white and white is black. Spend a lot of time at it and are paid a great deal of money. Because why? Because right now, from my observations, I have a little perspective now, put some years behind me, traveled a bit. From my perspective, I see industrial nations and corporations dictating the terms of existence for everyone. And that's where the leadership fails. It fails in that confrontational area of what's good for us and what's good for them. And them becomes very difficult because them becomes us in a way. In 1993, I was invited to Davos, Switzerland, by Dr. Schwab, who was the president of the World Economic Forum. It meets annually in Davos and has for some time now 1,000 or more of the corporations of the world. And that includes prime ministers, that includes presidents, kings, princes. They're there every 2 years. First 2 weeks in February. They set aside their competition, they come together, and they meet for 2 weeks and talk about what they're going to do for next year. They have the common sense to sit down and talk. They being those corporate powers. And why would prime ministers be there? Why would there be presidents there? Because that's the driving force of economics today. And everything seems to be centering around economics. So you will find small groups such as us here talking about environmental justice. Why? Because something's wrong. And We have the common sense to talk about it, to observe it, to see it, and to believe our eyes, not what we're told. So anyway, it was interesting for me, because the people I met there, I liked. Got along fine. All these CEOs and their cashmere sweaters. And no notes. There were no recordings. They just sit and talk. Krupp Steel. World Health Insurance. They're all there. Anyway, I got to be a very popular speaker. People say, hey, can you come over to our breakfast? Because they were meeting in these different groups. You know, and I just say what I was going to say. And finally, Dr. Schwab says, would you mind if you came over and address the Governor's Council? I said, the Governor's Council? Who's that? Oh, well, we have a council, a governing council. So there was a hierarchy of hierarchies there. And I said, why not? What do you want me to say? Oh, just talk to them. He says, I think they'll find your perspective interesting. So anyway, I went over. And there was a young scientist, Latino scientist from Boston University. And he was speaking. And he was speaking about the degradation, problems faced with extraction, because almost all industry begins with extraction. It all begins with the earth itself. Everything. Everything you see in this room begins somewhere on earth. Extraction. That's where the corporations are. Anyway, what he said, I agreed with. And I liked the young man. So after a while, then he asked me to talk. And I said, well, I have some questions for you. And I said, why is it that you, being CEOs of these very large corporations, educated and knowledgeable, and obviously know that Earth's resources are finite, why is it that you continue to extract beyond the capabilities of the Earth to reproduce? Can you tell me? That was an uncomfortable question for them, but they were nice gentlemen. I mean, you know, I enjoyed their company, like just like us, actually. Just very, very smart. So a gentleman, elderly man, I would say in his 60s, young man now for me, he says, well, Chief, I'll tell you, quite frankly, he says, I think I can explain it quickly. He said, I am the CEO for this large corporation. I take my directions from the stockholders and from the board, from the chairman of the board. He said, and he says, quite frankly, I must show on the bottom line at the end of a year a profit. If I do not show a profit, he said, I lose my job. I get fired. And I said, well, who are these stockholders? And he pointed his finger at me and he said, you are the stockholders. In a broad term. I said, so, I ask a question and I find out it's my fault. And he says, yes, yes. And I have to acknowledge, yes, he's right. Because it is a driving force, stockholders and the search for profit. So I asked him, I said, have any children? He says, yes, I do. I said, have any grandchildren? And he just brightened right up and he said, I got an 8-year-old grandson. And I said, I do too. I said, let me ask you another question. I said, when do you cease to be a CEO and become a grandfather? Now, there was silence. Because what I had presented to them was a moral question. It was a moral question. It was not an economic question. It was not a political question. It was about responsibility. What I was saying to him is, you know what you're doing. When are you going to be responsible for your grandchildren? That's what I was saying. I didn't get an answer from this group of leaders because it was a challenge. It got really little edgy. They didn't like that question. Okay, Chief, somebody says, okay, Chief, I heard a lot about Indian prophecies. He said, I heard a lot. He said, do you know any Indian prophecies you can tell me? So I said, yes, matter of fact, I do. I said, I sure know. I said, how about a guaranteed prophecy? They looked, they said, a guaranteed prophecy. I said, want to hear it? Yeah, we want to hear a guaranteed prophecy. I said, okay. You will meet next year and nothing will have changed. I'm an Indian, that's my prophecy, and I guarantee it. It was like, you know, we're playing gotcha, you know. And that pretty much broke up the meeting. But Dr. Schwab liked it. In his dedication to commerce, I detected moral quality. And I think that's what he was wanting. So that's the questions that you have to put to your leaders, or to your mothers, or to your fathers, or your grandfathers, the moral question. What about responsibility? And going back in time, when the Haudenosaunee was first conceived, shores of Onondaga Lake, after a great, great, great story, instructions were given to the new leaders, and one of them was, and I'm sure you've heard it, and I'm sure you remember it, because it's getting to be very common around the world these days. The peacemaker said to the new leaders, when you sit and you counsel for the welfare of the people, think not of yourself, nor of your family, or even your generation. He said, make all of your decisions on behalf of the seventh generation coming. You can reflect on that instruction. And that's an instruction about responsibility. And responsibility specifically to generations that are helpless, looking up from the earth, layers and generations, faces looking up from the earth, each waiting its time. And what is it that leadership is going to hand them? What kind of a life is it that you're going to have for your grandchildren? There may be more things, and technology may be extremely brilliant in whatever it produces. But what about the reality of the extraction in the earth itself? In this discussion with them, I talked about capitalism. I said, well, everybody pretty much is a capitalist. And I'm not really at ease speaking in these terms because I'm not that well-versed. But anyway, I understand that the basic principle of capitalism is you don't spend your capital. Is that right? Is that a basic principle? You don't spend your capital. You accrue your capital and you spend your interest. That's capitalism, right? So if you use the earth as capital, then you accrue the earth and you work on the interest. And what is that? And that's the law of regeneration. That's the security of futures and generations coming. If you work in that direction and you work within the capacity, then you'll have a future. And if you don't, you won't. That's all. Simple as that. In this meeting in Davos, the World Health and all the insurances and everybody were meeting, they had asked me to come over and be a luncheon speaker. I said, okay. So I was over there and listening to an elder, a doctor, and he was very old. And he had seen a lot of service. And he was talking about natural law. When I heard him speak, I understood what he was saying. And it was the first voice that I heard that really connected with what the way I thought, or my understandings. And he spoke very casually about this law, about life and death. Because if you're a doctor, that's what you deal in, life and death. And you deal most of the time in death, or trying to prevent it. But you become acquainted with it on a daily basis. And so I really responded to what he was talking about, made my way over to him after, and I said, how do you know about all that? Well, he says, you can't be dealing with life and death on a daily basis and not know about it. He says, we know about spirit. He says, there are times when we know the spirit has left the body, but not the room. He says, and we can fight to get it back. We know about that. That was a very interesting statement to me. And it came from a man of wisdom and experience, hands-on experience. I says, how many times are you able? He says, well, we don't count, but fair amount, he says. Enough for us to try. We know when the spirit has left the body, but not the room. So common sense, which has been given to all of us, and it seems like the more common we are, the more sense we have. Common sense is something that you have to listen to. You listen to yourself. Have some faith in your own thinking and feeling. Something doesn't feel right to you? Say so. Say so. Investigate it. Give yourself some credit. Don't let somebody come along, pat you on the head and say, oh, don't worry about that. Think about it. You have to be independent. And in these times, you know, counteractions and other developments are going to come from independent minds. People determined to do something better or determined to follow something to its end so they can see. And the wonderful thing about this great law of regeneration is the energy that a new generation has. Now I'm wearing out, my energy is about gone. I don't have that energy that I had 40, 50, 60 years ago. I don't have that. Gone. I have a lot of experience. Keeps me alive somewhat. But the energy, now, that's what you have. And you have a will. And you have to exercise that will. because that's what's going to protect you. And that's what's going to defend your family, your friends, your nation, your will. So in this discussion about environment, environment is us. We're it. We can't extract ourselves from the environment. We're part and parcel of it and probably doing the most damage in the world today. Water, 1.8 billion people today cannot drink clean water, have no access to clean water. 1.8 billion cannot find clean water. Things that you take for granted, you turn on a tap, and you expect it to be clean, and you drink it without thinking. I was invited to a meeting, three years ago now. I lose track. Anyway, it was in Sweden. It was at Lund University, and it was called by the Prime Minister on the issue what he called environmental security. That's intriguing. Environmental security. So, somehow or other, I was invited, don't ask me why, but I went, and there were very formidable people there. The head of NATO was attending. State Department from the U.S. was there. Probably wondering about my Iroquois passport. And probably wondering about me sitting there. But they were pleasant. I talked with them. But the discussion was environmental security. And it bordered on water. Next wars in the world are coming over water. And already are in process. Water. I forget exactly how many centers of water where there are more than four or five different national entities gaining their water from the same place, same watershed. And water is unevenly distributed around the world. It's not fairly distributed. It certainly isn't distributed according to people or populations. But where would you guess the most water, the most potable water in the world is? Where would you guess? Right here in the northeastern Canada, the greatest collection of potable water in the world. One third Great Lakes, Canada. Our lakes. Now, are we fortunate or what? Then why don't we protect that water? Just because we have the most. Now, Canada had to react to an uprising somewhat from Ontario, I believe, when they were negotiating with one of the Arabic countries for selling off the Great Lake water. How about that? Sure, you got something, they're going to come and get it. And they backed off from it. But that was just the openers. They're not going to go away. Then there was some of the Arabic countries discussing towing icebergs back down to where they live and getting the fresh water from the iceberg. Because water is life. I talked with Mikhail Gorbachev at this Hague meeting. I know him for over quite a long period of time now. I think I first met him in 1988. And we've interacted quite a bit. And I said, and he started International Green Cross. And that started from the Global Forum of Spiritual and Parliamentary Leaders. That's where that came from, which I worked with for a long time. Well, not that long. But anyway, there he was, and I asked him. International Green Cross was committed to rectifying damage done by human beings. So he was very concerned about nuclear waste, pollutions of rivers, military, all the military stuff. He told me, and we learned, you know, where these dumps are. You know, quite a few right around here. Off the coast of Seattle, big one over there. Inland Seattle, another one. But there's these dumps, which are like big time bombs. Anyway, this time, though, he said, I've committed to serve on a negotiating team between Jordan, Palestinians, and Israel on the issue of water. A war. And a lot of stuff that you're hearing about what's going on now revolves around access to water. Where is that spigot? Who can turn off what's on and what's off? They don't like to put it out publicly because there's a lot of agitation, fear. The bombings that we did at Kosovo, as was told by NATO, has put 200 years of damage there. That it's going to take 200 years to repair the damage from the Kosovo bombings. I don't know where else you'd hear that except you happen to be at a meeting with NATO. But they said, that's a problem. I said, not just Kosovo, it's a river. And rivers move. The Danube, how many nations are on the Danube? Turkey, and all, it runs right through there. And rivers are not even reaching the oceans anymore. And the biggest rivers in China runs out about 600 miles before it gets to the ocean. Because everybody's using the water. And with China already at 1 billion people, and compounding, the problem can only exacerbate. So, it was very interesting to sit in on that meeting and to hear these things that they were talking about. So sitting here is us, right in the best place to be if you like water. Then it really behooves everybody that's here to protect and take care of that. I mean, it becomes a mandate. So the wholeness is a discussion here of what we do and how we live. And Americans and America, the greatest polluter in the world, has the most massive industry in the world, consumes 1/4 of everything in the world, although we're only like 2.5% of the population. You just can't keep doing that. You just cannot. If you have any consideration for your grandchildren, and your great-grandchildren. If you have any responsibility, then you have to really be thinking what's best for them. So the instructions from the peacemaker were very profound. When we had this great meeting in Rio in 1992, UNCED, and they were going to establish on the environment what they were going to do for the next century, 21. There were two subjects that were not allowed to be on the table, that will not be discussed and was not discussed. One was population and the other was energy. Now how in the world are you going to determine what's going to happen in the next 100 years if you don't talk about population and energy? So it gives you an idea. And then First President Bush said in his 5-minute speech, he didn't want to be there. But he said that the United States would not abide any destruction of their standard of living. Now, everybody there was trying to say, well, how can we work together? How can we help? He said, I'm not going to abide any degradation of our standard of living. What kind of leadership is that? But that's pretty much where it's at, and it's still there. And we still have that problem. Speaking in the large terms, always in the large terms, thinking large, thinking big, thinking in the future, seeing far into the future. Visionary leaders. Some of you people here are going to be leaders. You're going to grow up and be leaders. And what is the instruction? And what are the values? So America has to come to terms with its values. What's important? I mean, we're learning about kind of how cold-blooded commerce is, because when California had its problems with energy, rolling blackouts and so forth, and suddenly there wasn't enough energy to keep their shops open. Well, that's not a true statement. There was enough energy, but they were not willing to pay for it because the energy was from other companies outside of California. So the other companies shut off the energy. They said, we're not going to give you this energy until you pay us. So they didn't run out of energy. They might have run out what they had within California, but there was energy all around. So what they did run into was good old American economics. Supply and demand, it's called. I got the supply, you got the demand, pay. No fairness there. No concern, just flat out opportunity. And is that what's going to continue to be the driving force? And if it is, where is it going to take everybody? Those are some of the things that I would have you think about. I don't know. I'm not an economist, but I do know common sense. And it seems to have common sense right now. And in our discussions with the global forum of spiritual and parliamentary leaders, after many, many meetings with a lot of people from all over, including Al Gore, we finally decided on a phrase that would encompass our whole being, purpose. And it was value change for survival. Tokyo, 1991, we agreed that that was the founding principle. Value change for survival. And included heads of state. A lot of people thought about it. Easily said. Easily said. So, I agree with that. We were part of that, Chief Shenandoah and I were there at that meeting. I remember Chief Shenandoah a lot, some of his quiet asides, you know. When we'd start talking about all the problems we're facing and everything, he would simply say, better start planting. Better start planting. A long time ago, 17th century, a Frenchman was walking through what we call New England, maybe up around Ontario, Quebec. He was just talking to these native people, and he says, what is this freedom that you keep talking about, free? What is that? I don't understand that you all talk about the same thing. And this Indian man went into his lodge, and he came out. He had a handful of corn. He says, this is my freedom. What did he mean? He meant that as long as you can feed yourself, you're going to be free. But if you're dependent, you're not. It's really a simple statement, but quite profound. I thought so anyway. I know that you've been, some of you, some of the students here have been learning a lot about the original people of this territory, the Haudenosaunee, ourselves. And we've changed the same way you've changed. You know, we're not, certainly not what we used to be. I guess none of us are. But we're fortunate. I think that the Council at Onondaga, Onondaga Nation, Cayuga Nation, Cayuga Nation in waiting, because they have all of the prerequisites. Tonawanda Senecas and Tuscaroras are the last traditional system in North America, either Canada or the United States, that's still in charge of land. The last of the chiefs. The last of the last. Every Indian territory you go to, west of us, will have a Bureau of Indian Affairs. They will have an elective system. At Onondaga, we do not. We still operate on the 1,000-year-old law. So it means that leadership is there for life for as long as they behave. It means that the women have a tremendous responsibility both in bringing life forward and protecting that life, nurturing the family, but as well in the politics of the day and the nation, they participate. And lucky for us, we depend on one another. Because like the creation and like everything else, balance is the key. Once you lose balance, then things are not going to go right. So today, here we have small groups of people still surviving on old instructions, old law. Now, I know a great deal amazing leaders and chiefs and women leaders in North America. I've met them. But they aren't in charge of land. We still are. And we've held our independence. And because of our instructions and because our values, the values of our nation is the family is first, community, respect. We've managed to deal with 500 years of real tough encounter. And in the meantime, share a lot of that. Our history is intertwined with your history so much that we're almost the same. But you don't know that. You don't know that. You don't know how closely we were involved in the development of your country, the political thinking, spiritual thinking, the laws. And so, at one time, if you were sitting on a cloud, way, 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 way up, and the cloud was drifting over the Great Turtle Island, this great continent called North America. In 1775 and 1776, you would have seen a glow of something happening, a brilliance, an idea that was growing, that was born. And it was our leaders that started that fire for you on those principles. But if you were sitting on that same cloud today and drifting over this great continent, you would have to look hard to see that spark that once was quite brilliant. It's gone down. You're losing your democracy. You're losing your freedom. And that hurts everybody. That hurts us. That hurts your future. Mother Earth. Mother Earth's seen a lot. Now, I know you guys are getting tired here. I'll tell you one more story. And this is the, again, at the meeting that we had of the Traditional Circle of Elders and Youth in Chippewa. They don't like the word Chippewa, they say Anishinaabeg. Where the Anishinaabeg are, they invited us, Michigan. Last year we had the meeting there. And at the meeting came a person, a runner from the north. He was from Greenland. He was the most interesting character that you ever saw. He had all of his traditional clothes. He was a professor. He could sing his songs. He had his drum. He was an amazing man. Found his way, don't ask me how, to this meeting, because we don't advertise this meeting. Here he comes, and welcomed him. Where are you from? The north. I have a message. What's your message? He said, the ice is melting. Really? The ice is melting? He says, yes. He said about 12, 13, maybe a few more years ago, they noticed that their great glacier, which rises 24,000 feet up, ice, that started to trickle, water started to trickle. They noticed this trickle. He says, when I left, just left, he said, there is a river of ice, water pouring out. And we've lost 4,000 feet of that glacier in less than 12 years. And he said, it's accelerating. He said, the ice is melting. It's changing everything. It's changing the eating habits of the bear. The polar bear is really suffering now. Because when the ice was out in these shelves, polar bear could wait by a seal hole, because a seal can only hold his breath so long, and he's got to come up, and the bear knows that, and he just finds a hole and he waits. Very patient hunter. When you're really hungry, you can really be patient. And when the seal comes up to get his breath of air, the bear grabs him. And so he has a meal. That's how he sustains himself. But now the ice is melting and it's moving back fast. And so there's open water. And so the seal does not have to have a hole to come up in. He can get his breath of air over there, and the bear can only look at him. He can't get him. So he's starving. The polar bears are starving. They're losing weight. And that's pretty much the way it is around the whole polar cap. While we were there at this particular meeting last August, was it? 2000? We had more information come from a runner from Alaska and that way, and he said that the ice had melted right through up near the North Pole, and there was a lake of open water that was 16 miles long. Open water, ice that was millions of years old, 12 feet thick, gone. Now, today. So I checked with a friend of mine, Lester Brown. Anybody know about Lester Brown? World Watch. He does World Watch. He just watches all the whole world. And he said, that's true. He says, you know. He says, the ice is melting not only there, it's melting in the Himalayas, it's melting in Switzerland, it's melting wherever there is ice. And then just not too long ago, there was a story, and you probably saw it, where the famous snows of Kilimanjaro have melted more than 82%. 18% of the snow left in Kilimanjaro. So it's melting all over. It's happening now, and there is change. I heard a long time ago that there were two things to watch for in observing and calculating the degradation of the earth itself. Two things that would be noticeable. The first one was the acceleration of the winds. The winds will accelerate. The winds will get stronger, and they will, and they're coming. We call our grandfathers. We depend on them. But they're going to come hard and strong, and they are. They are accelerating. The reason I know this is because the insurance companies are our allies now. They're saying, listen to these guys, they know, because the insurance companies got to pay for that. They have a very practical thing about this. So they know, they agree with us. The acceleration of the winds. And now we know scientifically what it means and how come. Warming, everything's warming. And with it generates heat. And with the heat generates wind. You're going to see it. It's starting to come through here now. You know, we've always had these safe valleys here in central New York. We've always had these safe places. But now, when was it? Last year or the year before where that wind came through? Knocked everything down, Syracuse. I watched it that night. Went around our territory. I watched it go by, listened to it. I said, somebody's getting pounded. And they were. So that was the first indication that the earth is degrading. The second sign to look for is how human beings treat their children. And that's a very serious consideration and charge, but it's there. It's there now. Children are being mistreated, exploited. In some sense, they always were, but not the way they are these days. 2.5 million homeless children in Sao Paulo. 50,000. New York City. Bogota, I saw them living in their boxes, cardboard boxes, 4 years old, 5 years old, crippled, deformed, and just breathing glue. How they passed their day, then exploited at night by the big people. How the people treat their children. So we have kind of heads up here. Something is happening. Serious. It's our problem. It's not your problem or my problem or Indian's problem. It's our problem. We have a problem. And we have to protect the future. And we have to somehow get responsible leadership. And you always start at grassroots. Always. That's where your power base is. Don't let anybody tell you any different. Grassroots is what will prevail if people know. So it's education, it's learning, being curious, and really thinking about values and thinking about responsibility and thinking about future generations, literally, and future generations of trees and everything else. Makes the world beautiful. This is a beautiful place. I do not believe that we are beyond the point of no return. But like Lester Brown and Gorbachev, and Ted Turner, and people who work in these areas, I figure we've got about 50 years. Now, 50 years in the sense of time of the earth is not even a blink. So, heads up, know it's coming, and begin to deal with it. And you will find that you have to begin right at home. You got to begin with yourself. Can't be solving everybody's problems when you got your own. Come to terms. Think about values. What are good values? And then think in long terms. Then raise your leaders. Raise good leaders. So I think, talked a little bit more than I thought I would, but I think that's about as far as I'm going tonight. And I just want to thank you for your attention.
That was Chief Orrin Lyons of the Onondaga, speaking at Ithaca College last month.
On May 22nd at 6:30 p.m., the annual meeting of Alternatives Federal Credit Union will be held at the Southside Community Center, 305 South Plain Street in Ithaca, New York. The guest speaker is Chuck Collins, an organizer for 20 years on issues of economic inequality, affordable housing, fair taxation, and globalization. In his talk at Alternatives' annual meeting, he will be addressing the growing gap between rich and poor in the U.S., the apartheid economy. Chuck Collins is the author of Economic Apartheid in America, a primer on economic inequality and insecurity, an action-oriented, movement-building guide to closing the widening gap between the rich and everyone else in this country. Mr. Collins will talk about the need to build and support institutions that will build real economic security. That's the annual meeting of Alternatives Federal Credit Union at the Southside Community Center, 305 South Plain Street in Ithaca, New York, on May 22nd at 6:30 p.m. Food and refreshments will be served at the meeting.
I don't know, good horse, as we trot in this dark heat, that Robin the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers and other brave. You change.